Okay, this is a special dialogue with Derek. We actually have an assignment, and someone has asked Derek, and he's passed on to me, to ask some questions for a book, answer some questions. And so, Derek, I guess I'll read it out. And shall I go? Shall I give an answer first, or do you have one ready to go?
No, I have some, but I mean, I'd rather hear you first.
Okay, so the first question is: in 1954, McLuhan wrote, quote, "He who would discuss humanism and literature today must know something about the history of media of human communication," unquote. Then this person asked the question: how could this apply to nowadays digitally interconnected society? Okay, so it would be, he who would discuss humanism and literature today must know something about the history of digital interconnected society. First of all, you got to know Finnegan's Wake, because that's the Bible quote that McLuhan is using all the time. It's the last book. McLuhan said that Ulysses was the last novel, but the last probe, the last book in literary form, is Finnegan's Wake, which came out in 1939, and McLuhan said several times, at appropriate points, he said his work is applied Joyce. So if humanism and literature are to be relevant to media effects, then Finnegan's Wake is the way to go. You have to look at that book, and you will be amazed, if you are familiar with it enough to look at it, to see that it actually is a book of email interaction. It even has the phrase emailia in it, E-M-A-I-L-I-A. When McLuhan said that all future technologies are already dealt with in Finnegan's Wake, who would have believed that? And then along comes this chaotic texting world, and a big chunk of Finnegan's Wake, it looks like texting. And that's pretty incredible, just on the formal level. And all other media that we know about can be seen in the formal dynamics of Finnegan's Wake. So how could this apply to nowadays? So humanism and literature, to the degree the book is an important part of humanism and literature, then when James Joyce says on page 52, television kills, telephony and brothers broil, the eyes demand their turn, let them be seen, then Joyce figured out how to write a book to keep the book in the mix of all the media dynamics that were happening, the media battles, the formal struggles in the ancient quarrel, including the quadrivium, I would add. Then you have to see that he figured out a way to preserve the book, and McLuhan in the 50s asked that question. He says, what's the role of the book and the writer today? And I see that McLuhan did footnotes to Finnegan's Wake, not to Harold Innes. Harold Innes was an academic put-on, but he updated Finnegan's Wake and applied it to this issue, and so we find that what he did with Finnegan's Wake with television and satellites and computers does apply to the internet world and the web world. So let's see what else to add to that. How could this apply to nowadays?
Go ahead. Just before you get into this, Joyce died in 1965, right, or 54?
No, James Joyce? No, he died in 41.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm sure, Derek.
I'm mixing it up
with Wyndham Lewis.
Figure. No, not with Lewis, with somebody else, but don't worry about
it. T.S. Eliot died in 65.
No. I'm mixing it up with Jung.
Oh, okay.
So it's J.J. Anyway, the point is, if he died in 41, why would he know anything about email, considering the email wasn't even born until...
Well, that's the point. The book is a prophetic book.
But let's not push it. I don't think that he would know E. The email is, unless people just pick it up from him, which is not a possibility either. I don't know. I don't get it.
You have to look at Finnegan's Wake. You have to see how incredible... I mean, it's... The dialogue parts around page 500, goes for many pages. It's usually seen as a telephone conversation or a radio interview, but you can actually see the chaos and rapidity of it. It can be attached to adjusted to emailia. Remember that he has that word in there, E-M-A-I-L-I-A, I mean, Joyce just let the words flow out of him, and he was sure to hit the donkey a few times, you know, with his new crazy words, portmanteau that he made. But when he said the eyes demand their turn, that meant that the book demands to be seen again in this post-literate world that Joyce saw happening. And he figured out a way to make it seen.
It's a very nice line. The eyes demand a turn.
Yeah. The television kills telephony and Brothers Broil.
Yeah.
The eyes demand their turn. Let them be seen.
Let them be seen.
and he has on page 349 a detailed description of the inventor of mechanical TV, a guy named Baird, B-A-I-R-D, and in the first line or two, he calls it the Baird board bombardment screen. Page 349, it's got all the parts of Baird's mechanism applied to religious issues. It's amazing how he nailed the TV effect, and he presents it right in the middle of the book in italics. So
right.
We know that he's talking about mechanical television on page 52 when he says television kills telephony in Brothers Broil.
Yes, I always love that sentence to which I understood nothing, and now I do. But but let me just answer the question on my completely different way. The whole question is, basically the question is a nice, more elaborate way of asking how do you apply the medium as a message to interconnected digital society?
Yes.
That's what it is. And my answer to that is, of course, that if you want to know what's going on, if you want to know what's going on with humanism and literature, you do have to ask about what's happening to the media. And, of course, literature is moving to video. It really is. A lot more people are watching videos and every now and then reading than before. And video is actually taking over. It's the eye, you know, the eye wants return.
Yeah. The eye has got a chance not being heard anymore.
But when you look at that, but the real question is about humanism. And humanism issue in the present context is what actually McLuhan had already predicted, which is that identity, private identity, is being wiped out.
Yep.
And so if it's being wiped out, the human of Thomas More and God knows who else, that's gone. And in fact, McLuhan said it would go, so did, the French guy, Foucault. Foucault talked about it.
Yes.
So it's true that if you know what media do to you, then you know what's happening to the human figure. So we talk about transhumanism, we talk about posthumanism and all these things, and we talk about artificial intelligence and robots, which are actually going to take over. We talk about singularity. You know, this digitally interconnected society is actually being transformed, and it's transforming its language about itself and about its transformation. That's how McLuhan would discuss, you know, the interconnected society. I think he would be very interested in finding out his own kind of... It's the one thing that's missing in the Decalogue that you and I have been fighting over the date of. The Decalogue is not... It talks about communication, but it certainly doesn't get anywhere close to social media. Marshall didn't get as far as like social media. So social media make an enormous difference to the humanistic dimension.
Well, McLuhan said that the book will change when TV comes in, when satellite. The book keeps going, it changes. But we're quite far along. I don't know what the book is for now. I don't know what people use it for. People tend to make shorter
books. I'll tell you what it's used for. I know what it's used for. It's unconscious. By the way, I learned a few really interesting things about the unconscious. But, yes, I'll tell you what it's for. The book is the only place where language is still. That's fundamental.
You said still, S-T-I-L-L?
Not moving.
Yes.
It's the only place where it's not moving. It's the place where your eyes, you as a person, is in control. That is, you control the speed, the meaning, the stuff. All of that is given to you personally in the silence of your mind. You know.
Yeah.
So the book is now the only guarantee of actually developing an internal consciousness. TV won't do it. Computers won't do it. Anything on a screen won't do it. They'll take it over. They'll literally swallow. They will be aspiring your identity, as McLuhan very well said. But I think that's what it is. I think that the book is the place where words stop, where people take control, where they decide how to interpret, where they make images instead of having the images made for them, where they have autonomy of mind and building of consciousness, building of identity.
Well, I've been saying for years that that's the reason we have a resurgence of fundamentalist religion in the United States or in North America, because if you're going to make the book what you're saying, it becomes archetypal, so you go with the archetypal book, the Bible, and so there's a mixture of medium and message in why people are becoming fundamentalist Christians and reading the Bible like they never did before. That is because the United States was built on the printing press. Let's go back to the first book, and that may explain why we do the book over here, and then the Arabs, they go for the manuscript.
Yeah.
So it's still an attempt to get visual space and archetypalize it. So what you're saying, preserving the silent mind, is part of literate religion. And that can explain why there's so many born-again people that showed up the last 30 years.
You know, one of the most predictive films of our stories of Bradbury was Fahrenheit 451, which became a quite well-known film, where people learn by heart because they're in a society which forbids reading.
Yeah.
They have learned by heart the great classics, and they transmit the great classics to each other in generation outside society. And when they're caught, they're killed because they contain the book.
Right.
And the book is supposed to be a source of division. I mean, I like it. It's very interesting stuff, and it's old, old kind of, you know, a prediction or a prophetic stuff. Let's move on to the second question, because, as I said, we won't have a whole lot of time, and I'd like to get through all of them.
Okay. Just a minute. I just moved my thing here. Where is it? Just a second.
I can read it. I can do it.
Yeah, you do it.
So according to McLuhan's essays and the late work such as the Gutenberg Galaxy, literature can be identified as a permanent metaphorical take on real life as well as an absolute medium of knowledge. To what extent would you apply this theory to the multitude of literary genres and historical periods? Well, my take on that is, of course, my work on Greek tragedy. How did tragedy actually, you know, express on the stage the drama of the separation from the tribe when an individual suddenly is projected out of the tribe like Oedipus, is kicked out of the city? The individual, it's a tragedy. In fact, Havelock had written about Oedipus as a tragedy of the intellectual. And, you know, it would be a Havelock thing to say. But the point is, tragedy was directly a consequence of the invention of the alphabet. And so there you have a literary genre that corresponds to a period that is repeated at the second blow of the alphabet, which was the printing press, where tragedy becomes in England, France, and elsewhere in Europe, again, a very important genre. So the genres themselves have a life, and they die, or they transmute. But tragedy disappears in the end of the 18th century because it's become very banal, and because, in fact, novels have taken over. So you see, you can actually apply this to our own time. People now basically work out the new literature online. The first novels online, which were collective novels, were done, in the 90s. There had already been several. There was the call, one which was called Marco Polo, I remember. But what's happening now is that you have people who are creating novels together. I don't know if you know a website called Wattpad. Wattpad.
No.
Millions of people are contributing their novel pieces according to several directions possible offered by the collective writing that particular thing, and everybody's published and everybody takes part of it, and it's a huge world phenomenon of literature. So this kind of collective writing is something that wasn't really, I mean, yeah, you had authors like Labiche who usually wrote with Martin, and then you had pairs maybe sometime, but rarely did you have a collective writing. Today, collective writing has been the way to respond.
But that's not literature. Is it only online?
Yeah, it's only online.
That's not literature.
Well, no, sometimes it's published. No, it is literature.
It's typing.
Well, of course it's typing.
What's his name said?
No.
Truman Capote about Jack Kerouac.
Wait a minute. It is maintained. It's not, like it's archived, right? So it is literature.
No, when you're looking at it through a screen, if you follow McLuhan, it's not the effect
of
the book.
Agreed on that point, on that point of view. I'm just talking about what's happening to the word. Oh, no, of course, anything that you see on screen is
screen.
You should have your lawyer to support you. It's really terrible.
Right, but looking at this question, this is a badly stated question. Literature can be identified as a permanent metaphorical. Well, what's a metaphorical take on life? All media are metaphors. So that's not a good statement, as well as an absolute...
I understand what it means, though.
Well, I think he's visually biased. He thinks the book is where everything ends up, you know, the famous statement by Mallarmé or somebody.
Maybe that's one thing, too, but what I see as a permanent metaphorical take on real life is that we write and read our novels as parallels to our condition, to our position, and to our expectations. I mean, any novel is read with you identifying with the actual structure that you take over for the world that you're reading. It's definitely something that is a parallel to our own life. And so that's what the metaphor is. And
okay, so why is it an absolute medium of knowledge? It's an absolute medium of knowledge in Western man, Western humans. The condition by visual space, yes, it's the archetypal medium, but only in the West.
No, for sure. But, I mean, within its own realm, I mean, again, I'm interpreting the question as I understand it, and the idea of the absolute medium of knowledge means, in fact, that's badly phrased. Don't forget that Andrea is Italian. But I believe that what that means is that it is clearly something that gives you knowledge.
All right. So then he says, what does this theory, or these sentences in the first sentence, these phrases, how do they apply to the multitude of literary genres and historical periods? What does that mean? Apply this to the multitude of literary... Apply what? That it's the absolute medium of knowledge? It's just more room to do much of every media expression. That's what's happening today. You've got an incredible outpouring in all media, I call them Baroque spirals, of expression that's beyond any human ability to find the significance in. So you're going to get more and more bizarre mixtures of typing, and history will be forgotten, but it'll be typed about. I mean, this theory, the multitude of literature and historical periods, this guy hasn't read McLuhan properly. I mean, I'm assuming you want to know what McLuhan's saying. History is not available now. What we have is virtual history, which is books online. That's virtual history. That's within the screen and people typing and reading, but not having the book effect that happened 500 years ago. And that book effect created a parallel track, and that was visual space, and that was history. But history died in 1945, according to McLuhan, literary history. So I would say this guy has to rethink the question. Because it's not really, when you know McLuhan stuff, you don't know how to answer this.
No, the way I saw it was that all the genres that have developed, I mean, you remember also in Hamlet, you know, the discourse about all the different kind of genres, but the fantastic explosion of different direction that literary creation at the time could actually take, and today we definitely are in a similar kind of explosion time, and of all kinds of different ways of writing, different ways of storifying, and the whole idea is, you know, you would talk about storifying.
Yes.
So the historical periods that I see are explosion of genres, in fact, twice, you know, in the Renaissance and in the... in the Renaissance, post-Renaissance, and then right now. And so I find the question interesting in that sense, as I find interesting also the suggestion that it is a metaphor, that is, I forgot, Marshall used to love the double plot. You know,
yes.
He used to talk about it, and that's exactly, one could say that the novel is the second part of a double plot, of which the first part is me.
Do you know the term Apelian?
Apelian. That's exactly what I was looking for. That term.
Yeah.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
So to give rise to that thinking is actually useful, even though I think you're right. It's not very good.
He doesn't even have a theory here. Okay. So It's a metaphor for real life. What's that got to do with literary genres? Well, people are so fragmented and got multiple bodies now that they will express all kinds of different genres of visual space.
Sure.
But it would not be a singular real life. They've got multiple real lives now. See,
yeah.
It doesn't connect. Would you apply this theory to the multitude of literary genres? Well, there's going to be as many genres now as people typing, because people are free to mix anything, to bash cliches with archetypes, as McLuhan would say.
True. Yeah.
You know, so you can't even classify it now. You wouldn't be able to classify genres. That's done. So his theory does not apply. And at historical periods, it's hard to determine what time it is now and whether there can be a history. Matter of fact, a lot of the typing, the after image of the Gutenberg Galaxy, is people are trying to find out what time it is. And that's a literary question, and that's all they're going to type about. And guess what Finnegan's Wake is? The key question is that the main character gets asked by the cad, he actually asks the cad in the park, what time is it? That is the main incident.
This is very Joycean. Okay,
yeah.
Let's move on to number three.
Okay, I'll
you
do this
ahead.
One. In an effort to define McLuhan's favorite literary canon, as well as ranking the most meaningful authors, which ones do you believe... Jesus. Let me read this again. In an effort to define McLuhan's favorite... An effort to define his favorite literary canon, as well as ranking the most meaningful authors, which ones do you believe would stand out? Oh, geez. Well, let's see. He loved the vortices, okay? He made a big deal out of Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, Wyndham Lewis, and James Joyce, and maybe some Yeats. And
yeah.
He always...
Yeah, I would add Yeats.
What, beg your pardon?
I would add Yeats, for sure.
Yeah, the emotional multitude comes out
Absolutely.
Of Yeats. But the way McLuhan... recycled those guys in the Playboy interview. They were metaphors for his four senses. They were metaphors for all kinds of other dynamics and memes in his system. And so whether he, and McLuhan used to also say that if he talks about something, he's against it. So
uh-huh.
He might have been against the vortices as a Catholic or some other thing because he was very suspicious of Gnostic influences in literature, or he pretended he was. Anyway, so his canon, his favorite canon would be Menippean satire.
Mm-hmm.
That's what most of the people cited in Gutenberg Galaxy are Menippean satirists. And then Eric has developed that into a PhD. Then again, he did not think that literacy was the most valuable experience that he could have. He looked at every medium and looked at its services and disservices. He said, all the competing claims made by cultures in the global theater, none of them can dominate. None of them can say, oh, we're going to take over. Our sensibility is going to be projected. He saw the interplay. He just didn't want them canceling each other out. So you can preserve them by knowing the ratios and dynamic symmetry of tensions among these different cultures and media. And that is a very ecological view of the new nature, media as new nature. And so a literary canon is puny as one of his concerns. You know, it's not a major concern about the literary canon. His literary canon is stated in the 40s. He talks about T.S. Eliot. Look at those unpublished essays and books. He still was working out his preferences in the Gutenberg Galaxy. But by 1962, that's not a concern anymore.
And excuse me, but why don't I see Shakespeare among those?
Well, no, he would put Shakespeare in there, but he actually, as a Lewisite, liked Ben Jonson better.
He quotes Shakespeare all the time. King Lear, he quotes Mallarmé a fair bit.
Yes, but you notice that he talked about the joke of Shakespeare and Company, which is a pun on Sylvia
yeah.
Beach's bookstore, but Shakespeare and Company was a cliche operation that he was not impressed with in the traditional theater repertoire. But he would pick out the media angles in Shakespeare, like the prediction of television. Nobody believed that one. I can't remember which play that was in. Remember the guy sees a shining light and thinks it's a television, McLuhan says. And then you got King Lear suffering visual space on the moor. He would only use Shakespeare for making media points. And it's very interesting when he writes about it back in the 40s and 50s. he likes Ben Jonson. And he picked up on that from Lewis. So Shakespeare was too much of an archetype for McLuhan to sort of put on up in a favorite style. He's going to look for someone else. He's going to look for someone that nobody knew about. I don't know, who would that be? He'd have to look up some names in his PhD. And like, what's his name? The guy, Thomas Nash. He liked Thomas Nash.
Yeah. You know, the other thing, yes, of course he liked Nash. After all, he wrote about it. But the other thing is I find very restrictive the idea of applying only a canon of literature when you would have to say that many other books quoted often had an enormous influence on Marshall, like Lucerans, Jacques Lucerans, and There Was Light.
You know who had a big influence before Innes was Gideon.
Yes.
And another guy, just for the record, the first influence is Bernard Muller Thyme, T-H-Y-M. He learned tactility from Muller Tim. You know him in St. Louis?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and he was a scholar, or maybe even a student of Gilles Sand, Bernard Muller
Thyme. Is it Thyme or Tim? It's with an E or without an E at the end?
It's T-H-Y-M, Muller Tim. But I've heard people say Muller Thyme, so I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but he was McLuhan tells a story in, I guess, the spring, summer of 39, it would have to be before he took off to Italy in August when he got married. They're sitting in a bar, he and Muller Tim, opening up Finnegan's Wake. They got the copy, and it came out in the spring of 39, and that's the man that McLuhan shared opening the book up. He probably went to page 69 first, right?
Yeah. Absolutely, isn't
it? It was Bernard. I mean, that's quite an archetype experience. The guy that you share the book with when you first get it, that's a pretty good friend. And then he turned out to be a pretty good guy on Thomas Aquinas and the tactile interval. And it's a missing part of people knowing about. People don't know about Gideon and Muller Tim.
I should have known about the tactile dimension because, I mean, when I wrote the book, I put the book together of
Point of Being.
I should have mentioned that. For sure.
Yeah.
It's very important. And also, I'd like to go back to it now that you mentioned it. Where will I find the tactile writings of Muller Tim?
I think Cameron McEwen has done pretty good research on that.
Okay.
Do you know that name?
No.
I'll send you his email later.
Okay.
let's see. Yes, literary canon. You know what we have today? McLuhan, in Understanding Media, presents a media canon. He chooses media as the big factor in human influence. Other people would say, no, not media, but they'd say other things, DNA or something, genetics. But the canon that Marshall created was a media or meme canon, not a particular Gutenberg. That's too specialized.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course.
It's a media canon that has.
It's a media canon, absolutely. And this is the point. I will answer that to Andrea for sure. Because it's important to recognize that it goes beyond the kind of narrow number of people that he was reading and that are specifically related to literature. Then on the other hand, one thing one has to say is that Marshall's love for literature was permanent, and maybe there was more to saying that everything was literature rather than some books were that side or the other. He loved words. He loved the well crafted words. He loved puns.
Well, you remember, you would see at his office in the 70s, George Thompson would, bring over a pile of books from St. Michael's, and Marshall would take them home in the evening.
Yeah.
A lot of books that guy processed.
Oh, and he wrote, I think he read reasonably fast, too.
Yes. Now, but let's just take the words, the question on its face. Which ones do you believe would stand out? Well, the obvious ones are what I call the vortices. Joyce, Lewis, Pound, Eliot, and Yeats. They're the obvious ones. And then maybe Thomas Nash and Cicero, Virgil, and some other guys way back there. Rabelais. The Stoic, the pre-Socratics. I think he got interested in them. So that's not hard to understand. But my point is, no, that's not the question you want to ask. That's not relevant. You want to look at the media canon, not the literary canon.
No, for sure.
Okay, you want to read the next one, number four?
Yep. Just hang on there. I'm getting back to it. Because I've lost it. Oh, here we go. How would you explain McLuhan's claim regarding Poe as the founder of symbolist literature as well as the mastermind behind the discovery of the process of discovery theory? And, I know that he was very interested in the techniques of Poe, which he explained using the Raven, and then, of course, also the descent into the Maelstrom, so that it was always about process. Nevermore would be, first of all, he would say that thanks to Poe, the artist and the poet could begin to look at the results or the effects and then come back to create that effect, but put the effect before the cause. That was very much a Poe kind of, I think.
Which came out of newspaper writing.
Which came out of newspaper writing for sure, because in fact you had to get the attention of your reader in a way that was pretty...
And because you serialized it, you had to know where your story was going, so you would figure it out before you presented it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's and then, of course, there's the other thing that he was fond of repeating, that Whitehead, Alfred North Whitehead, had talked about the greatest invention of the 19th century was the idea of invention.
Yeah, the technique of discovery.
The technique of discovery, which means the process of So we've got. Yeah, I think we've got that one pretty well.
Well, wait a minute. The thing is, it's McLuhan really made a beautifully symmetrical theory. You have Poe creating the detective story. Mm-hmm. And the doctrine of the effects precede the causes in making poetry, that becomes the study of the process of creativity, which comes through in Electric Age, of the extension of central nervous system, the extension of the process of the brain, say. So the symbolists were inspired by Poe. It's so symmetrical that he finds Poe as the first to do this, and he can apply it all the way through the symbolists. He called them the second phase of symbolists. The Romantics, the Keats and Shelleys are the first phase of symbolist poetry. And then that leads to Eliot and Joyce, and he makes a really coherent case if he begins with Poe. It's beautiful. And then he says, then you see in the global theater era, when people are always in an interrogative mood, he said, they're always asking, what do you do? It's an always, the citizen's forced to probe all the time about what's going on because so much is going on. And so people are looking at pattern recognition and trying to figure out what's causing this or that. And so the very, what he called Copernican Revolution, the third one of pattern recognition, it's so beautiful how Poe was the archetype, and then everything followed from that. And it's such a good theory, I thought it was fact. I don't know if one could say that Poe, it was just a theory that he influenced the symbolist literature. It's sort of well known that he influenced Mallarmé and Baudelaire. Isn't that true?
Baudelaire. I have to check if Baudelaire is included.
No, Baudelaire. They all made a big deal out of Poe.
I think Mallarmé, I know, but because Mallarmé did one of the most beautiful poems of all on the epitaph to Edgar Poe.
Is that right?
Calme bloc ici-bas, chute d'un désastre obscur.
No, I don't know that.
Le poète suscite avec son glaive nu le peuple épouvanté de n'avoir pas connu que la mort, triomphe dans cette voix étrange. Questo è il primo... This was the first strophe of that wonderful poem. It's absolutely super. I know it by heart because it is so beautiful.
Well, Mallarmé, he can even be more important than Baudelaire, because he went, with Un Coup d'Etat, he went very extreme in using letters as a probe, and that therefore it he pushed the envelope, so that opened the way for Pound and Joyce to go further than Mallarmé, but they couldn't have done it without Mallarmé first. So if Poe influenced Mallarmé, that's good enough.
Yeah.
That's enough.
I'm just checking about Poe and Baudelaire because it's an interesting issue. And yes, there is a paper on Baudelaire, disciple of Edgar Poe? Question mark. Baudelaire, traducteur de Poe. No, you're right. There is Baudelaire actually translated Poe, and I'd forgotten that. You can see I'm getting senile. Anyway, now we've got it. My mind is clear, and so you know. But it doesn't matter being senile if you have Wikipedia. Anyway, so let's just move on to the next one because, as I said, I'm going to have to leave probably after the next one. My friends having been there and being very patient.
Okay, so I'll read this one.
So, yeah.
In the final chapter of the Gutenberg Galaxy, McLuhan identifies symbolism as parataxis, that's quote parataxis, unquote, and a kind of witty jazz, unquote. To what extent the knowledge of ancient, that's Cicero and Quintilian, and Christian rhetoric, that's Augustine Thomas, Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, I guess, and Peter of Spain. What extent did they play a role in the definition of symbolism in the era of electricity? I have a pretty good answer for that. You look up in 1965 in Letters, and McLuhan's letter to Tom Wolfe, he's just been interviewed by him, and he wants to expand the context of whatever he said to Wolfe, and a very important statement is made there that the patristic fathers were anthropologists. And as anthropology comes in the 19th century, as we know it, it influenced the poets. And the way people started to, in the 19th century looking at symbolic patterns was a precise retrieval of the medieval sensibility of the fathers. And it's incredible that most people assume the symbolists were decadent pagans. But to say that their antecedents were Catholic monks and priests and missionaries is quite a satirical statement, but McLuhan can make a case that those guys were the archetype for the symbolist approach. Do you know what I'm referring to?
No, I don't know about that particular part of the McLuhan scholarship. But what I do, it makes me think, is the way the the parataxis issue.
Yeah,
I just found it very interesting, and it'll come back in another question as well. The idea that his writing is parataxic, Marshall's writing was parataxic, and of course so was Joyce, but Marshall's even more so. And so the parataxis comes ahead of the internet and
hypertext.
It does, and hypertext is in fact a kind of treatment of parataxis that has that offers many options as opposed to simply giving you just two things to connect.
Right.
And so I find that very interesting, and I find it because considering that storytelling or explanations in pre-literate times was paratactic by nature. Something was, and then something was. And
yes.
Just as, for example, in Africa, when you ask your way around in the traditional African sense, people actually tell you where it is by what are the things around it.
Yes.
The first thing that is confronting you connected to the next thing is not necessarily going to be given to you. So that linear kind of progressing to the point of where you want to get is not coming naturally to their minds. So what they do is parataxic. And so the post-literate era will have a return to parataxis, but with and something very similar to the African way of describing how you get there.
Right.
When
he says, to what extent the knowledge of ancient Christian rhetoric played a role in the definition of symbolism in the era of electricity, I don't know who's defining symbolism in the era of electricity, but if anybody, it's McLuhan. And
yeah.
he laid this out, and therefore he created the paradigm, then it's a fact that symbolism is a replay of Christian rhetoric, because that's what McLuhan said.
Yeah, and then you could also play it back with the five levels of...
rhetoric.
Five levels of rhetoric for sure, but the biblical.
The four levels of exegesis.
Four levels of exegesis. That would be where I would find when you're getting at the allegorical stage.
Yes.
That necessarily relates to the anagogical stage, then of course that's where the symbolism could be seen.
Yes.
That the allegorical is actually giving you with all the attributes and so on.
Well, that could be the second school of symbolism. Is the telegraph has come in, the book's in crisis, visual space in crisis, and therefore symbolist poetry and in the later vortices are flailing around for what's called ultimate mysteries on the eschatological level, electricity caused that kind of symbolist probing, the eschatological probing, and that definitely was a product of the electric obsolescing of visual space. So there's a neat thought for you.
Yep. Okay, man.
Well, we'll do the other five. What is there? Yeah, we'll do the other five next time.
Yeah, you're right. I'm here tomorrow.
Okay, I can't do it tomorrow, but maybe Monday or Tuesday.
Fine. All right.
Okay, so let's end at that. Great talking to Derek, and we'll continue soon.
All right.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.